to Air in Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 27th of January 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAlbion.com. Well, I'm afraid my co-host Max Musson has come down with a dose of multiculturalism. He apparently went to London earlier in the week, and of course he's managed to contract some kind of virus there. Because as we well know, these multicultural areas are full of all these diseases and viruses and illnesses, strange illnesses that arrive on these shores from over the other side of the world. And of course, we've got these problems at the moment with that, with coronavirus. But that's a global news story that I'm not going to get into today. We're going to talk about British news today. And last week, there was a bit of a shocking court case took place. Listeners probably remember earlier in the year, there was a white police officer who pulled over a driver in a van. The driver was a black guy. I think he had a Jamaican accent. He had dreadlocks. And he didn't have any insurance. And the police officer pulled him over to ask if he had any documents, to if he could show that he had any insurance. And when the driver pulled over, he then launched an attack on the police officer with a 2-foot machete, hacked the guy across the head and split his skin open. Don't know if he split his skull. He had to have stitches. A really horrific attack. That part of it was actually caught by passers-by that managed to film it. And he was lucky that he had a taser on him and he was able to taser the attacker. And he survived. And there was lots of cheers for the fact that he had survived and what a brave hero of a police officer. And this is the sort of thing that the police have to put up with. I mean, we may be critical of them for enforcing speech laws, which, you know, that's not the police's fault. That is the government's fault. They're the ones that actually make these laws. But we mustn't forget that, you know, they're doing a really dangerous job. They are dealing with people that might have machetes on them, might have acid on them, might have guns on them. And we do hear more and more often of police officers being attacked by the people that they're trying to arrest. And in this case, you would have thought that the guy that attacked him would have been given a substantial prison sentence because the state does back up its police officers, usually. But in this case, he wasn't backed up. Or at least, it may not have been the state's fault. Well, half of it was the state's fault, as we will see. But a jury found him not guilty of attempted murder. And not guilty of possession of an offensive weapon. One of the reasons why they did this is because the courts refused to allow the jury to hear the previous offences of the black attacker. And the previous offences included knife crime and rape. Obviously, a bad sort, basically. But the jury weren't told that, and the jury found him innocent of carrying an offensive weapon. And that's just unbelievable. This was in London. This took place in the city. What possible reason could he have for having a machete next to him, in the van? It's not like it was in the back, in the boot, that he needed it for work, for chopping down bushes. It was right next to him. And yet they found him innocent of that offence. And then on top of that, his lawyer, who also happens to be non-white, is now calling for the police officer to be reprimanded for using excessive force. Unbelievable. A lawyer was condemned for her despicable suggestion yesterday that a heroic police officer should be disciplined for saving his life with a taser during a vicious machete attack. The row erupted as smirking Muhammad Rodwan, 56, was jailed for 16 years for attacking PC Stuart Alton, after he stopped his white van because it was not insured. The 29-year-old victim, later dubbed Britain's bravest policeman, survived the onslaught last August only by firing his taser twice at the homeless driver. PC Outon had fallen to the ground as Rodwin came in for the kill with a 2-foot rusty blade, smashing the officer over the head with it. I mean, how the hell can they say that that is not attempted murder when you smash a guy over the head with a machete? He hasn't shown an ounce of remorse for this. In actual fact, he said, well, my life is more important than his. But it's not like he was being arrested. It's not like the police were trying to cart him off anywhere. They had he just literally pulled the guy over to ask for his documents, to do a document check. The thug was acquitted of attempted murder on Thursday and convicted of a lesser offence of wounding with intent to cause grievous bodily harm after jurors were not told about his violent past. I mean, you smash somebody over the head with a machete, the chances are you're going to kill them. And you've got less chance of surviving that than you have got of actually dying from that. Just the fact that that was the wound that was caused showed that this guy had murder in mind. He wasn't just trying to grievously bodily harm this police officer. He didn't care what he did to the police officer. The trial judge ruled that evidence about a strikingly similar machete attack by Rodwan on two men in 1996 and other convictions for rape and drugs should not go before jurors due to the length of time since the offence. But it's the same offence, though. And they just admit that. They say it's a strikingly similar machete attack 20 years ago. And he does the same thing to a police officer, and the judge rules that the jurors shouldn't be told about that. So what they've done is they've put the supposed human rights of this black would-be murderer ahead of the rights of the general public to be protected from people like this. What happened to this white police officer's white privilege then to be let down like this by the system? Yesterday, Solicitor Sophie Khan, who has represented people injured by taser and campaigns against excessive use of the weapon, defended the convicted criminal by saying he acted in self-defense in the face of excessive force from PC Outon. How is that self-defense? If the guy is being arrested, that's resisting arrest. That's not self-defense. You can see on the video, he just walks around there to the driver's side, and then he's attacked by this black guy, who obviously had the weapon there right next to him on the seat. She wrote on Twitter she was surprised the Metropolitan Police haven't started disciplinary action against PC Outon for assault and battery on Mohammed Rodwan. And to be honest, so am I surprised, actually. I mean, we know how anti-white the system is. I mean, I would be saying it ironically that I'm surprised the Metropolitan Police haven't disciplined him for his racist actions against this innocent black guy who was just innocently driving around with a machete on the front seat. Now, she means it seriously. This lawyer Khan, she means it seriously. She thinks that he should be reprimanded for defending himself. Well, what should he have done then? Should he have just allowed it to happen? He should have just allowed himself to be beheaded by this guy? She added the officer's actions were in part found to be an excessive use of force, and that the case had shown there remains a risk to the public by police misuse of the taser. So this was a misuse of the taser, was it? Saving a police officer's life? There have been instances of people mistakenly hit with a taser, but you think of how many lives it has saved. I mean, the days when we used to be able to have a bobby on the beat with a truncheon and that would be it, they've long gone. And the reason why they are long gone is because we are multicultural. Britain used to be the envy of Europe for its law-abiding citizens and for the pleasant and peaceful land that was England, basically. There was hardly any crimes that used to take place. You can look at the statistics, particularly for things like knife crime. You can go back to the 20s, and in a whole year there wouldn't be as much knife crime in the whole of Britain as there is in one day in London today. And it all started increasing once they allowed the non-white immigration. That's when crime began to explode. And of course, now we're in such a situation that people who have actually been robbed, only 5% of those cases are even looked into. They're now saying that theft cases, the criminals are just going to get away with it. The police don't have enough resources to actually investigate these crimes, purely because of the weight of so many crimes that are going on. And it's all due to diversity. If you want to avoid this, just move to an area that is all white people. You can see this just by looking at the crime figures for the countryside. And some people might say, well, that's because there's a different mindset in the countryside. There isn't so many people. But if you go to the cities of Eastern Europe, the capital cities of Eastern Europe that are also 99.9% white, you'll find that they're just as safe as the British countryside, even though you're in a capital city in Europe. You know, you can walk around Vilnius in Lithuania or Riga in Latvia, and you will feel just as safe as if you're in the countryside in Britain. You could leave a mobile phone on the table, go outside and have a cigarette, come back, and the mobile phone will still be there. You can look around and there'll be no litter anywhere because people just don't drop litter. And they just don't have the crime rate that you have in a diverse city. There was a tweet that was sent out the other day by Based Poland showing what it was like on the underground in Poland. All white people. No trouble. No litter. People just being friendly to one another. If you go to London, you have to avoid everybody's eye. Nobody says good morning to you or good afternoon to you. They all try to avoid speaking to one another. There's just a tense feeling of anticipation of when the next act of violence is going to be. Diversity is not a strength, and it was deliberately imposed upon us by the people in power for whatever reasons. I'm sure they all must have had different reasons, some of them because they thought it was going to make more money, it was going to keep the wages down. Others because they thought it was going to help with getting left-wing people elected. And others because they just hate white people and they wanted to see whites replaced. And they knew the trouble that would come from bringing in the third world. This is what a lot of people don't get. There are people that are deliberately doing this. They're shielded by people that believe in all the multicultural guff and do believe that we are all the same and it's all just about equality and it's all about just giving these non-whites a chance, and they are being picked on by the state and the establishment, and everybody else is racist. And there are a lot of people that do believe that. But then there is a small group of people that know the truth that are just doing it out of hatred for whites. And you can tell that from the things that they say, the anti-white people that say things in the press, particularly about these Muslim grooming gangs, that it's wrong to say it's a Muslim grooming gang, it's wrong to say that it's centered in Pakistan, these girls were asking for it, they should just shut their mouths for the good of diversity, as one of our non-white MPs said recently. And of course, our fellow whites, who obviously aren't actually white, but say some incredibly hateful things about white people whilst pretending to be white, they're the sort of people that are doing it deliberately. They know the truth, but they are shielded, as I say, by people that don't, by genuine do-gooders that are just misled, basically. And that's why it's so important that we have voices that do speak the truth, that we do have platforms for alternative views, so we can point out the things that maybe they hadn't thought about themselves. Getting back to this article here. Her criticism of the victim provoked outrage yesterday, as Metropolitan Police Federation Chairman Ken Marsh said, "This police officer stopped a man lawfully and politely asked him to get out of the vehicle because he did not have insurance. He responded by getting out a machete and brutally attacking him and my colleague very nearly lost his life. If it wasn't for that taser, he would have died. See, and this is the thing. We can't have the police just going around with truncheons now. The police need to have weapons because of the violence that has accompanied the immigration policy. London is the centre of all this violence, and it's 60% non-white. Manchester, Birmingham, all these cities that are, Bolton, all these cities that are now minority or coming up to being minority white, have an incredible rate of violent crime that is going on in them. And the police need to be protected from that, or else they're just not going to be effective, are they? I mean, there is, that may be one of the reasons why they are clamping down so much on so-called speech crime, because that's a much easier thing to do. It's not risking their lives, is it? It's very rare that somebody who has been accused of saying mean things on Twitter is going to resist arrest by sinking a machete into the head of the arresting officer. So I do think that the police, they naturally have to be careful around these criminal types, and they need to be armed. They need to have at least a taser to protect themselves. And this is exactly what a taser should be used for. When a police officer is fearing for his life, he needs to have a weapon there. This is let alone the women that they've got as police officers now. And don't forget, last year we saw somebody resisting arrest, and they kicked the woman officer over, and her head was about 6 inches away from a London bus wheel as it went round the corner. And then we've got instances where the police have been trying to arrest black criminals, and they managed to break themselves free, and all the onlookers are cheering on the criminal. They weren't friends of him. They weren't friends of his. They didn't know who he was, but just because he was black and he was trying to escape from the police, they were cheering him on. When you just have a singular group of people in an area, when you just have white people, if the police are trying to arrest somebody, the other white people there will be assisting the police. They won't be cheering for the criminal. They will be assisting the police. We used to have a thing known as a citizen's arrest. You could arrest somebody if you saw them breaking the law and then hand them over to the police. Certainly couldn't have that in a multicultural zone. Metropolitan Police Federation Chairman Ken Marsh said these comments are utterly despicable. She is not only inciting violence, but she is condemning a hero who detained a dangerous offender while he was fighting for his life. Now, I don't quite understand where she was inciting violence there, whether she's maybe it's because she's encouraging people to fight back by saying that, it was just self-defense, and it's clearly resisting arrest, and the guy is clearly a hero that was willing to take on somebody as dangerous as this. I mean, thankfully, a member of the public went over and grabbed his radio for him and held his radio up to him so that he could call for help. I dare say if that had been the criminal type, they would have been stealing the radio or trying to steal his car. And that's the sort of thing that we've seen happen in the multicultural areas. Mrs. Justine Carr, sitting at the Old Bailey yesterday, rejected the notion that PC Outon had used excessive force, describing how arrogant Rodwin flew into a rage when he was stopped by police for having no insurance in Leighton, East London, on August the 7th. So where did this idea come from, that he was using excessive force? It seems this lawyer just plucked it out of thin air. The judge told the criminal this was a brutal and shocking attack. I reject the unattractive submission that PC Outon was using excessive force in circumstances when you had assaulted him and forcibly resisted arrest. So he didn't use any force until after he had been attacked by the black criminal. She praised the officer's presence of mind and fortitude in tasering his attacker. Footage from his body-worn video shows PC Outon fighting for his life after Rodwin stabbed him repeatedly, fracturing his skull. bleeding from 6 gashes to the head and 1 to the arm, the officer tasered Rodwan twice and brought him to the ground, just as he was preparing to strike again. So, and if he'd struck him again, he would have killed him. What is up with this jury? What is up with the jury to find the guy innocent of attempted murder when he was just about to lunge in for the kill strike? The judge told Rodwan, who had claimed he was acting in self-defense, "I detect not a shred of remorse or insight on your part, but rather belligerent arrogance." She ordered him to serve at least 2/3 of his 16-year sentence, with a further 3 years on extended license. So what's he going to do there? 10 years. 10 years is all he's going to get for that. He may even be out in half of that time. I mean, she said he's got to serve at least 2/3, but he'll probably make excuses, pretend it was good behaviour, appeal it and say that there was some racism somewhere here. I mean, maybe race played into this as to why the judge wouldn't allow the jury to hear his previous offences. They may have said that because he's black, that may prejudice the jury if they hear that he's been involved in exactly the same crime 20 years ago. Just amazing. And you would hope that this was a bit of a wake-up call for the police themselves, that the state is not going to back them up. You know, they are white as well. And juries, when they see the television and they see all this nonsense about police picking on black guys and they see Black Lives Matter and all this propaganda that the American police, they just attack these black criminals for no reason. And then these guys on the jury, when they see that there's somebody black that's been accused of this, they're going to be more likely to go easy on the black criminal, because there's all this hatred that's been directed against the white police. The reason why so many blacks, and it really isn't that many, but so many blacks get shot in America is because they resist arrest. They're far more likely to resist arrest than white people. And the reason why so many more blacks get arrested than their percentage of the population is because so many of them commit crimes. They're far more likely to commit crimes than the rest of the population. What is it they are in America? Something like 13% of the population, and yet they commit 52% of the murders. And it will be the same over here in Britain. It's the same everywhere, which is why they try to hide it. They try not to tell us the ethnicity of the people responsible for crimes. I think the last time we were actually told the ethnicity of people that were responsible for crimes in Britain was about 2010. But of course, we do have the David Lammy report, which told us that there were something like 5 times as many blacks in prison as their percentage of the population, which of course he said was down to the judges being racist and down to the police being racist, when of course it's not. It's down to the criminality of these blacks. It's not like they were found innocent. They went to court, they had a jury, and the jury found them guilty. It's not like the police were planting evidence on them. The last thing the police want to do, the last thing a white police officer wants to do is arrest somebody black, because he knows that there's always going to be a chance that he's going to be accused of racism. He's going to be more likely to arrest somebody white. He's going to wait until he's got absolutely damning evidence on the black guy before he pulls the black guy over, because he doesn't want to be accused of being a racist. That's the last thing they want to be accused of being. Next story that I've got here today is about the NHS, basically. And there's been a lot going on recently about this Tavistock Institute, which is basically the NHS Gender Reassignment Department. And they've been giving hormone blockers to children and giving them cross-sex hormones. And a lot of people are now growing up and they're in their 20s and they're realizing that they didn't actually want to change sex, and they're furious about the damage that's been done to them. and the NHS is now being taken to court by some of these poor people that have had these, that have ruined their lives, basically. They don't know if they're ever going to go through puberty because they at the time they were supposed to go through puberty, they took these puberty blockers and then they took the opposite sex's hormones. So the NHS are actually being taken to court about this now. And there's been a lot of cases of these people that are saying in the mainstream media that they regret doing this. And they're saying, why isn't it? Why are the NHS not looking into why there has been this massive increase in people claiming that they are transgender? Because it's a thousands of percent increase in the last 10 years. Thousands percentage increase. And the number of children that are saying that they actually think they were born in the wrong gender. And of course, there are various reasons for this. The promotion of this in the mainstream media, the promotion of it in the schools, the power that it gives to a child that they can dictate what the teacher calls them and that they can scold the teacher for using the wrong pronouns. And on top of that, we've got the problems with the hormones that are all in the environment, which and the hormone blockers in the plastics and the traces of female hormones from the contraceptive pill that are all in the water. The average testosterone levels of men has dropped by 20% in the last 20 years. So we've got all these hormone disruptors in the environment, and we've got all this promotion of transsexualism on the television and in the education system. That is obviously going to be encouraging this to happen. That's going to be one of the causes of this huge increase. But nobody's investigating it. When somebody turns up at this clinic and they say, my daughter or my son is having these gender identity problems, the people in the clinic, they have to affirm the gender confusion. They're not allowed to say, well, are they autistic? Do they have an eating disorder? Have they ever had any instances of body dysmorphia? Have they ever been abused? You know, there are all these questions that they should be asking, and they're not allowed to ask them it. They have to reaffirm their gender identity that they wish to be. And in some cases, people have only been seen by these doctors two or three times before they have then been put on these powerful drugs. And they are experimental drugs because we don't know what the end result is of giving somebody cross hormones. This has only been going on for a few years. We've only had the technology to do this for a few years. It's not like there's anybody in their 60s or 70s that's lived a whole life after doing this when they were a child. And a large part of this court case centres around being able to give informed consent. Because how can a child give informed consent on something that is going to mess up their chances of being fertile, mess up their chances of having children, mess up their chances of being attracted or being able to form a happy sexual relationship with somebody that they are attracted to if they haven't gone through puberty and they don't understand what sex is? They don't understand what those feelings are. And yet they're being told that, well, we are being told that these children can actually give informed consent to going on these courses of medication. So it's great that people are finally taking the NHS to court over this. But so many people have been saying for the last 3 or 4 years that this is terrible. What is going on here? Something needs to be done about this. Why has it taken so long for this to happen? Why hasn't the mainstream media been interviewing these poor people that have mutilated themselves and messed themselves up by taking the opposite sex's hormones? Why aren't they promoting them? Why do they tell us that there's a huge problem with suicides with transsexuals and it's because of people being mean to them? Why don't they tell us the truth that these transsexuals that commit suicide is after they've had the operation and they've realised that they can't actually change into the opposite gender? It was a pipe dream. It's not real. They can't change the size of their hands. They can't change the size of their feet. They can't change their shoulders. They can't change their chromosomes. There's far more to being a man or being a woman than just the superficial issue of what you look like. And just the fact that some of these women that are pretending to be men say that, oh, I wanted to get pregnant. And we have this concept of the man that can now get pregnant. And that just shows that they're not men within a woman's body, because no man would ever want to be pregnant. The fact that they still have these feelings shows that they are actually women. And these children that are going on the course of this medication, the likelihood is that they'll never be able to have children. And look at the struggles that people have to have children once they find the partner they want to be with, all this IVF that people go for. The NHS is setting itself up for masses of lawsuits, I think, in the future. When these children come of age and when they realise what's been done to them. So we'll have to wait and see what the outcome of this is. And thankfully, there has been some mainstream media coverage, particularly in the Daily Mail. Okay, as I'm here on my own today, I think we're going to have a music break. And this is a Hungarian band. And really, it should have been on the Aryan Audio Insurgency Best Of episode that I did with Hallandir. It was one of the best tunes of last year, but we never managed to fit it in. This is Romanticus Erosiak with Becha Balada, and I'll be back in 3 minutes.
Híres neves magyar betyár vagyok, kegyetlen urakat nem szolgálok. Páros pisztoly a csizmám szárába, rész kokosom a nyerek kápába. Páros pisztoly a csizmám szárába, rész kokosom a nyerek kápába.
Kergetnek, akkor én elszökök, a pénzváltók törvényére köpök.
Ha kergetnek, akkor én elszökök, a pénzváltók törvényére köpök.
Kegyelemre védi a tűztek ki a fejemre.
Akasztófa után nincs vágyásom, széles pusztán van az én szállásom.
Akasztófa után nincs vágyásom, széles pusztán van az én szállásom. We'll be right back.
te szép Magyarország, mint halálig hű leszek te hozzád.
Szülő hazám, te szép Magyarország, mint halálig hű leszek te hozzád.
Szülő hazám, te szép Magyarország, mint halálig hű leszek te hozzád.
A fantastic bit of folk rock there by Romanticus Eroshak. And if you like that, do check out the Aryan Audio Insurgency on Thursdays when we play all the latest nationalist music for you. Well, we're going to move into the Greatest Britons section now, and it is unfortunate that I haven't got Max here today because he suggested these two particular Britons, and we haven't actually had any women yet. And the two that we have for you today are two female aviators from the last century. And I think the point that Max wanted to make with these is that women have never been oppressed. Whenever women have wanted to do something different other than to get married and bring children up and be a housewife, they've always been given every kind of encouragement to do that. It's up until the rise of feminism, 99.9% of women just wanted to get married and have children, because that's what their mother did, and that's what their grandmother did. And they were brought up around their mother and their grandmother, and they were taught how to be a good housewife. But there are always exceptions to the rule. And these two that I'm going to talk about today are those exceptions to the rule. And they were given every bit of encouragement as a young man might have been given who wanted to become an aviator. Amy Johnson is the first one. CBE. So she was honoured for what she did. She was born on the 1st of July 1903 and she died on the 5th of January 1941. So she was only 36 years old when she died, unfortunately. She was a pioneering English pilot who was the first woman to fly solo from London to Australia. Now, this highlights a point that I made last week as well about women doing these world records. If it's the first woman to do something, that means it's the second person to do something. And this is why I was saying that it's not really such an important achievement for women to do things, because obviously men have got more body strength and men are going to be the first to do something. So obviously it was a man that was the first to fly solo from London to Australia. And this woman doing it, she would have been the second or the third. So it may be a record for women, but it's not really a world record. We'll see with the second aviator that she did actually break a world record, and all credit to her. Amy Johnson was introduced to flying as a hobby, gaining an aviator's certificate on the 28th of January 1929 and a pilot's A licence on the 6th of July 1929, both at the London Aeroplane Club under the tutelage of Captain Valentine Baker. In that same year, she became the first British woman to obtain a ground engineer's C licence. So she became an engineer as well. And lest we think that she's some kind of a lesbian, she did get married. Johnson obtained the funds for her first aircraft from her father, who would always be one of her strongest supporters, and Lord Wakefield. She purchased a second-hand de Havilland DH-60 Gypsy Moth and named it Jason after her father's business trademark. Johnson achieved worldwide recognition when in 1930 she became the first woman to fly solo from England to Australia. Flying the Jason, she left Croydon, Surrey on the 5th of May and landed at Darwin, Northern Territory on 24th of May, 11,000 miles later. 6 days later, she damaged her aircraft while landing downwards at Brisbane Airport and flew to Sydney with Captain Frank Follett while her plane was repaired. And this is a dangerous journey, you think back then in 1930, right the way across the other side of the world. She received the Harmon Trophy as well as a CBE in George V's 1930 birthday honours, in recognition of this achievement, and was also honoured with the number one civil pilot's licence under Australia's 1921 air navigation regulations. Johnson next obtained a De Havilland DH-80 Pussmoth, which she named Jason II. In July 1931, she and co-pilot Jack Humphreys became the first people to fly from London to Moscow in one day, completing the 1,760-mile journey in approximately 21 hours. From there, they continued across Siberia and on to Tokyo, setting a record time for Britain to Japan. You imagine what these planes were like back then, held together with string and bits of sticky tape, really, and practically made out of balsa wood. And it's incredible the distances that they were actually able to fly. In 1932, Johnson married Scottish pilot Jim Mollison, who had proposed to her during a flight together some 8 hours after they had first met. And that was the sort of thing that would happen back then. A man would meet a woman, and very, very soon they would propose, within a matter of weeks or whatever, because the idea that you could just date different men and sleep with different men, it just didn't happen. A man would meet a woman and he would pretty much fall in love straight away. I mean, because the man wouldn't have had this much experience and he would have this great lust for the woman. And she probably hadn't seen that much of men before. And people would get married and they would grow in their love. The love would come as they got older. At first, there would be this sort of lust for one another. And then as you got older and as you had children, you would gradually grow more into love. I mean, it's almost like the arranged marriages that they have in places like India. And the boy may have only met the girl once, but once they've been married together for 10 or 20 years, then they're in love. And that was the way that marriage used to be. It all used to be arranged. None of it was based on whether the woman was attracted to the man or not, because we knew that if you could fall into love that quickly, then you can very easily fall out of love. You know, you basically had a system that was best for the production of children and best for keeping the family together. Obviously, by this time in our existence, we'd stopped doing that and we'd stopped having arranged marriage, but people would still get engaged very, very quickly. Unlike today where, you can have people that want to live together first or whatever, and they could be courting for 2, 3, 4 years before they eventually get engaged. But she was 8 hours before she got engaged anyway. In July 1932, Johnson set a solo record for the flight from London to Cape Town, South Africa, in Pussmoth GACAB, named Desert Cloud, breaking her new husband's record. I bet he wasn't very happy about that. In July 1933, Johnson, together with Mollison, flew the GACV, named Seafarer, AD De Havilland DH-84 Dragon 1, non-stop from Pendeen Sands, South Wales, heading to Floyd Bennett Field in Brooklyn, New York. The aim was to take Seafarer to the starting point for the Mollison's attempt at achieving a world record distance flying non-stop from New York to Baghdad. Running low on fuel, and now flying in the dark of night, the pair made the decision to land short of New York. Spotting the lights of Bridgeport Municipal Airport, now Sikorsky Memorial Airport in Stratford, Connecticut, they circled it 5 times before crash landing some distance outside the field in a drainage ditch. Both were thrown from the aircraft, but suffered only cuts and gashes. After recuperating, the pair were feted in New York society and received a ticker tape parade down Wall Street. Imagine that. These are the days when you couldn't fly at night either. You needed to have the daylight there and you needed to have clear skies, I guess, so you could see where you were going. The Mollisons also flew in record time from Britain to India in 1934 in GACSP, named Black Magic, a De Havilland DH-88 Comet, as part of the Britain to Australia McRobertson Air Race, but were forced to retire from the race at Allahabad because of engine trouble. In May 1936, Johnson made her last record-breaking flight, regaining her Britain to South Africa record in GADZO, a Percival Gull 6. The same year, she was awarded the gold medal of the Royal Aero Club. In 1938, Johnson overturned her glider when landing after a display at Walsall Aerodrome in England, but was not seriously hurt. Well, that's quite incredible as well. You think she's had, three accidents there in the landings, but she's managed to survive each one. On the 5th of January 1941, while flying in Airspeed Oxford for the ATA from Prestwick via Blackpool to RAF Kidlington near Oxford, Johnson went off course in adverse weather conditions. Reportedly out of fuel, she bailed out as her aircraft crashed into the Thames estuary near Herne Bay. And of course, this was during the war, and she was involved in flying out supplies, but they didn't actually have any female fighter pilots during the war. A convoy of wartime vessels in the Thames estuary spotted Johnson's parachute coming down and saw her alive in the water calling for help. Conditions were poor. There was a heavy sea and a strong tide. Snow was falling and it was intensely cold. Lieutenant Commander Walter Fletcher, the captain of HMS Hazelmere, navigated his ship to attempt a rescue. The crew of the vessel threw ropes out to Johnson, but she was unable to reach them and was lost under the ship. A number of witnesses believed there was a second body in the water. Fletcher dived in and swam out to this, rested on it for a few minutes, and then let go. When the lifeboat reached him, he was unconscious, and as a result of the intense cold, he died in hospital days later. And this is one of the risks of when you have women in the army. A man's instinct is to risk everything to rescue a woman. And this man risked his life here, and he ended up dying. Would he have done that if it had been a man that was in the water? Possibly not. He may still be alive. He may have lived if it had been the other way around. In 1999, it was reported that Johnson's death may have been caused by friendly fire. Tom Mitchell from Crowborough, Sussex, claimed to have shot Johnson's aircraft down when she twice failed to give the correct identification code during the flight. Mitchell explained how the aircraft was sighted and contacted by radio. A request was made for the signal, and she gave the wrong one twice. 16 rounds of shells were fired, and the plane dived into the Thames estuary. We all thought it was an enemy plane until the next day, when we read the papers and discovered it was Amy. The officers told us never to tell anyone what happened. And in 2016, Alec Gill, a historian, claimed that the son of a crew member stated that Johnson had died because she was sucked into the blades of the ship's propellers. The crewman did not observe this to occur, but believes it is true. Now, this is interesting that she gave the wrong code when she was asked for it, because this is something that women do. We know that they signal, basically. If they like a male, they will signal. And it's part of the courting ritual, basically. And they will expect a man to respond to certain signals. And one of the signals that women give out is the deliberate mistake. And they will make a mistake. And they can't help themselves making the mistake. Sometimes they'll do it deliberately, but they can't help themselves doing it. And the evolutionary theory behind it is that because they've made this mistake, it will draw the attention of the man. And I wonder if what happened here is if she didn't inadvertently signal and give out the wrong password. Maybe she liked the tone of the male operator's voice, and she gave out the wrong passcode. I mean, it's a possibility, and this is the fear of when you have women that are maybe flight captains or are responsible for things like lorry drivers and what have you, and they make one of these mistakes that they do, and it could cause a terrible accident. If you want to know more about that, then read Simon Shepherd's work, Sex and Power, and he lists all the different signals that women give out and the evolutionary theory behind them for the reasons why they do it. But it could be that's what happened here. Because why else would she give the wrong passcode when she was asked for it? She knew how dangerous that would be, and yet she did. And unfortunately, from as much as I can make out, she didn't actually leave any children behind. So even though she was this great aviator, even though she broke all these world records, and she obviously had good genes, she didn't pass them on. She didn't pass them on. So ultimately, even though she did these great things while she lived, she never left any descendants to live after her and continue the line and do other great things. Which is another point that I wanted to make. I mean, it's all very well women doing the things that the men do and doing very well at it and beating the men at doing it. But the one thing that women can do that men can't do is become mothers. And mothers of huge families, I mean, they're the heroes to me. There's a woman, I think she's called the Yorkshire Shepherdess, something like that. And she's just written a book, obviously lives in Yorkshire, lives on a farm. She's had 9 children, and half of them were delivered by the side of the road, by herself. I mean, that's a heroine to me. Someone who is a good mother and brings up a huge family and knows what to do in every circumstance. I mean, somebody that can just give birth themselves, that's pretty incredible. That's the sort of women that we want to be honouring. That's the sort of women that are now honoured in Russia and are honoured in Hungary and were honoured in the Third Reich, where awards were given out for people being good mothers and for having as many children as possible. You know, we treat it today as if motherhood really isn't that important and it can just be franchised out. And you can just get somebody else in to look after the kids while the mother goes to work. It's not. It's one of the most important jobs of all, if not the most important job of all, to be a good mother. And maybe if Amy Johnson had taken a little bit of time out to have some children, maybe she would have lived for a lot longer and she would have been able to teach her child to walk in her footsteps and given them some of the knowledge that she had and some of the drive that she had. Well, the second female aviator that I'm going to bring up here is Beryl Markham. I must admit, I'd never heard of either of these two ladies before until now. I suspect they're probably put forwards as being examples of feminists. But they don't seem like they were feminists to me. I mean, they got married. They did what they wanted to do, basically. And women have always done what they wanted to do. It's just that most women didn't want to be engineers. They didn't want to fly aeroplanes. They just wanted to do the things that most women want to do. But there are always exceptions to the rule. But it doesn't mean that the rule doesn't exist. In fact, it proves that the rule does exist. And the second lady here is Beryl Markham, née Clutterbuck. And she survived a lot longer. She was actually born 26th of October 1902, and she lived to the 3rd of August 1986. And she was an English-born Kenyan aviator, one of the first bush pilots. She was also an adventurer, a racehorse trainer, and an author. She was the first person to fly solo, non-stop, across the Atlantic from east to west. So this wasn't a case of the first woman to do something. This was the actual record. She was the first person to fly solo all the way across the Atlantic. And she was English. She happened to live out there in Kenya, but she was of English stock. When she was 4 years old, she moved with her father to Kenya, which was then colonial British East Africa. He built a horse racing farm in Njoro near the Great Rift Valley between the Mau Escarpment and the Rongai Valley. On her family's farm, she developed her knowledge of and love for horses, establishing herself as a trainer at the age of 17 after her father left for Peru. And all women love horses. I mean, it's not out of the ordinary for women to be involved in training horses. Malcolm may be best known for her solo flight across the Atlantic from east to west. When Malcolm decided to take on the Atlantic crossing, no female pilot had yet flown non-stop from Europe to New York, and no woman had made the westward flight solo, though several had died trying. So this is a very risky thing that she was taking on here, a very dangerous trip, and she must have just had that drive that she wanted to do this, she wanted to succeed, and she wanted to do it off her own back without having anybody else there accompanying her. Malcolm hoped to claim both records. On the 4th of September 1936, she took off from Abingdon, southern England. After a 20-hour flight, her Vega Gull, the messenger, suffered fuel starvation due to icing of the fuel tank vents, and she crash-landed at Baleen Cove on Cape Breton Island, Nova Scotia, Canada. She became the first person to make it from England to North America non-stop from east to west, and was celebrated as an aviation pioneer. And you think about that, the fuel was getting all iced up. Obviously not something that they had thought of when they were designing the plane or thinking about flying for that length and that distance. All these sort of things that they were just discovering through trial and error. Basically, this was still a time of adventure and learning new things. Still in the age of discovery, really. I mean, this is right at the time when they'd really just first learnt to fly. And it was all a question of trial and error. But that was the main thing that she did. She was just the first person to fly right the way across the Atlantic. But she actually wrote about this as well in a book, because when she got back, there really wasn't that much of a fuss made of her. Amy Johnson actually won lots of awards, and she won lots of honours, and if you look up the Wikipedia page, half the Wikipedia page is filled with places that are named after her, and all these things that were done for her. But Beryl Malcolm pretty much disappeared into obscurity after making this flight. But she did actually chronicle her many adventures in her memoir, West with the Night, which was published in 1942. Despite strong reviews in the press, the book sold modestly and then quickly went out of print. After living for many years in the United States, Malcolm moved back to Kenya in 1952, becoming for a time the most successful horse trainer in the country. Unfortunately, there was an instance where she got burgled as well, obviously by the usual suspects. Even back then, it was still the same as today. If you're a white man, then you've got to watch your back over there in Africa. Malcolm's memoir lingered in obscurity until 1982, when California restaurateur George Gutekunst read a collection of Ernest Hemingway's letters, including one in which Hemingway lavishly praised Malcolm's writing. So he was praising her writing rather than praising the fact that she flew across the Atlantic. Intrigued, Gutekunst read West with the Night and became so enamoured of Malcolm's prose that he helped persuade a California publisher, North Point Press, to reissue the book in 1983. The re-release of the book launched a remarkable final chapter in the life of the 80-year-old Malcolm, who was lauded for her three final years as a great author as well as a flyer. So it was good that she finally got some recognition at the end of her life. And she had two or three partners in her life. I think she was married twice and had some kind of an affair. But again, as far as I can make out, she didn't actually leave any children. She didn't leave anybody behind to make use of her genes. I mean, it's all very well them doing these amazing things and being these amazing flyers, but they didn't pass on that ability to anybody else. And that is the main function of the woman, is to become a mother and pass on those genes. I know Max wanted to bring these women up. Maybe he wants to inspire the women in our audience. And if that's really what women want to do, then they should be allowed to do it. But they shouldn't all be encouraged to do it. They shouldn't be told that this is what you should be doing. You should be doing what the men do. Women should be encouraged to be mothers. If they're not mothers by the time they get to 40, 45, then that's it. They're not going to have a chance. And they're not going to have any grandchildren to be the delight of their lives when they're in their 60s. I mean, I'm not for saying that all women should be banned from working or anything like that. Just that women should be told the truth. Everybody should be told the truth. And encouraged to do what they're going to be most happy with. Women are going to be most happy with one partner and having children. They're not going to be most happy with working. But they've been sold this lie that they are somehow oppressed by men by being a housewife and serving a husband who loves them. And again, this narrative that women were oppressed and were never allowed to do other things. I mean, these two stories here just show you that wasn't true. And they didn't need to have diversity quotas to get these women as aviators. These women became aviators through their own merit, through their own hard work. They weren't saying, I'm a woman, so I should be allowed in. How about you have a woman on the team? Because you've got 10 men. Where are the women? We need 10 women on the team as well. There was none of that. They were good at what they did. And they were given their awards and they were given their qualifications because of their own merit, not because of what gender they were. That's the way we used to be. We've always been a meritorious nation, trying to base as much as we can upon merit. And now we're doing the opposite of that. And we're basing things just on what race somebody is or what gender they are or who they sleep with at night. And all of that should be irrelevant. It should just be the best person for the job that gets the job. Anyway, thank you very much for listening today. I'm sorry Max wasn't here. I'm sure he would have had quite a bit to say about these two ladies, as it was him that picked them for this week. I hope you've enjoyed that. Don't forget, we do need your donations to keep Radio Albion going, and we do have a Bitcoin wallet on every page that you can donate to. I will be back next Monday, hopefully with Max, for more of Aryan Britannia. And until then, I hope you'll have a great week ahead of you.